We're very glad to have Brother Jerry's service again, the second service of this convention, and he has a very unique title. I hope it catches your attention. The title simply is Finders Keepers. Brother Jerry.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Aaron, and also Brother Joe. Appreciate that. I guess I, too, have a confession to make. I've got to go to, right after the talk, I've got to run to the airport, so I apologize for that. Sometimes these things are just unavoidable, so I think all the brethren understand that. I have really enjoyed myself at the convention. The fellowship has been sweet. We thank the brethren here in Chicago for their efforts. We thank our hosts, the Whitakers, for making us feel at home and so comfortable. So it has been a joy to be part of your family for this weekend. Finders, keepers. You might want to just turn to Matthew 13, because that's pretty much where we're going to be for the bulk of our thoughts this afternoon. In Matthew 13, I think you're all pretty familiar with this. Jesus tells a series of seven parables of the kingdom of heaven. And I'm just going to rattle them off. 1 to 7, the parable of the sower, the wheat and the tares, the mustard seed, the leavened bread, treasure hid in a field, the pearl of great price, and the dragnet. In Matthew 13:10, Jesus' disciples asked him, "Why speakest thou unto them in parables?" Jesus answered in verse 11, saying, "Because it is given unto you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to others it is not given." Of these seven parables, Jesus offers some sort of explanation or interpretation in only three of them: the sower, the wheat and the tares, and the dragnet, which are numbers 1, 2, and 7 in this series. In parables 3, 4, 5, and 6, Jesus offers no explanation at all as to how the parable is like the kingdom of heaven. In the three parables where Jesus explains how the parable is like the kingdom of heaven, the explanation involves either a successful or an unsuccessful harvest. Some will hear the parable, understand the message, and bear fruit. They will be part of the harvest of the gospel age. These are the ones that Jesus referred to, who are given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. In the parable of the sower, they are the seed who bear fruit and bringeth forth some 100, some 60, and some 30-fold. In the parable of the wheat and the tares, they are the wheat that are gathered into the barn in the time of the harvest. And in the parable of the dragnet, they are the fish that are gathered into vessels. And in these same three parables, there are those who hear the message of the kingdom, and for various reasons, they do not go on to bear fruit, and so will not be part of the gospel age harvest. These are represented by the seed that fell by the wayside, the seed that fell into the stony places, the seed that fell among the thorns, the seed that was sown by the enemy, which produced tares, and the bad fish that were cast away. These are the ones Jesus referred to who were not given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. So in three parables that Jesus offers some explanation, there are two possible outcomes. The one leads to knowing the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven and to a successful harvest. The other leads to not understanding the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven and to an unsuccessful harvest. Two outcomes, one positive, one negative. And so the question that we might ask ourselves is this. Is there a common theme running through this series of seven parables? If parables 1, 2, and 7 all have two possible outcomes, can we make the argument that parables 3, 4, 5, and 6 will follow the same pattern and also have two possible outcomes? Now, it is my understanding that all seven of Jesus' parables in Matthew 13 could quite possibly have two possible meanings or outcomes concerning those who hear the message about the kingdom of heaven. They may all follow this pattern or theme that we saw in the three parables that Jesus offered an explanation. Now, due to time restraints, I will only be trying to explain how one of these four uninterpreted parables, the treasure hid in the field, can have two possible outcomes. The treasure hid in the field is found in Matthew 13 and verse 44. It's really short. It's like one sentence, and it reads as follows. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto treasure hid in a field, the which when a man hath found, he hideth, and for joy thereof goeth and selleth all that he hath, and he buyeth that field. In this parable, the one central, primary point of the story is there is a field, and in that field there is a treasure worth everything a person can give in exchange for it. The field is the world and everything in it, including the dominion lost in Adam. And the man who sold everything and bought the field is Jesus, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross and laid down his life as a ransom for Adam in order to purchase Adam and the entire human race, which is the treasure hid in the field. Jesus' ransom has not yet purchased the treasure. The whole human race. It has only purchased the church. And once the church is complete, it will share in Jesus' great work and pass the merit of his sacrifice on for the purchase of the whole human race, for the cancellation of the sins of the world at the close of this age. To be a member of this church class, we must, as Brother Russell says in reprint 45, 36, have our Lord's character and likeness and must, like him, sell all that we have that we might share with him in this great work. And so we see the successful harvest, the good outcome of the parable of the treasure hid in a field. Those who hear the gospel message and understand it, and who then joyfully sell all in order to purchase the field and the treasure hid in it, will be a part of the mediator who helped the world of mankind up the highway of holiness. These will be a part of the harvest of the gospel age. And this is who Jesus was referring to when he said, "It is given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom." And now, let's look at the possibility that there may be another outcome to this parable. The outcome that leads to an unsuccessful harvest for those who were not given to know the mysteries of the kingdom. Now, to be clear, I am speculating and reasoning on how Jesus might have intended the parable of the treasure hid in a field to have two different outcomes. And I offer it as food for thought, nothing more. Now, that being said, and with these thoughts in mind, let us consider the parable from this secondary perspective. Because this parable is only one line, it doesn't have any plot development like a longer story would. But it still is a story, so the hearer must work out the insight that is suggested by the parable. So we are going to fill in the plot development left out of the story. The parable begins by Jesus saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like unto treasure hid in a field." Now, let's just pause here for a second to think about this. A treasure hid in a field suggests that it's buried. Otherwise, it wouldn't really be hid very well, would it? Now, we don't hide our treasures in fields or in our backyards anymore because we have federally insured banks and we have safety deposit boxes and we have, you know, strong safes that we can hide somewhere in our home. But hiding buried treasure in ancient times was not uncommon at all. And it was especially true in times of distress. In his work called Jewish Wars, Josephus reports that among the ruins of Jerusalem after its destruction, the Romans recovered much of the city's wealth of gold and silver and other most precious articles, which the owners, in view of the uncertain fortunes of war, had stored or hidden underground. So a story about buried treasure would not be anything unusual for Jesus' audience. But the treasure in Jesus' parable is not a literal treasure. It is a metaphor for the kingdom of heaven. Now, the metaphor works like this. The thing that we are familiar with, in this case, a treasure, is comparable to the kingdom of heaven. The thing that we are not familiar with, because no one has yet fully experienced the kingdom of heaven. So, it is our job to figure out how these two things, the treasure and the kingdom, are alike. Now, fortunately, we don't have to rely on only this use of treasure as a metaphor for understanding the parable. And that is because this isn't the only place in Scripture where treasure is used as a metaphor for a thing of value. It is also used in the Old Testament. And the lessons we can learn from the Old Testament uses of the finding treasure metaphor can be very instructive in how we understand this New Testament use of the same metaphor. Now, in the Old Testament, treasure is frequently associated not with the kingdom of heaven, but with wisdom, as in Proverbs 8, verses 10 through 11, where it says, "Receive my instruction and not silver, and knowledge rather than precious gold. For wisdom is better than rubies, and all the things that may be desired are not to be compared to it." Now here, treasure is the silver and gold is comparable to wisdom, and specifically knowledge of God. So in the Old Testament, one other aspect that we need to keep very clearly in mind, a critical aspect of the metaphorical structure of treasure representing wisdom or the knowledge and understanding of God, is that it is something that has to be diligently sought after. It has to be searched for before it is found. It is not something you can accidentally stumble upon, and it is not something that is just handed to you. You have to put in the effort if you are to find it. We read, for instance, in Proverbs 2, verses 1 through 5, Proverbs 2, verses 1 through 5, "My son, if thou wilt receive my words and hide my commandments with thee, so that thou incline thy ear unto wisdom and apply thine heart to understanding, yea, if thou criest after knowledge and lifteth up thy voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for treasures, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God." In Proverbs, the hidden treasure, the wisdom of God, is actively sought. You must apply your heart and incline your ear. You must lift up your voice and cry after wisdom, the understanding, and the knowledge of God. You must seek this treasure, this thing of great value, or you will not find it. Because by not seeking, you have proven that you are not worthy of it. God does not give such a precious treasure to someone not willing to diligently seek it with his whole heart. In the Proverbs passage, we assume the one seeking the treasure, the wisdom of God, is worthy of it. Because instead of seeking worldly treasures, he is seeking to know God, the thing that God most wants him to be seeking. And for this reason, we have no reason to question the character or the motives of this seeker of godly treasure. That is because into the parabolic structure of these proverbs, there is a correspondence between the treasure, the thing of value, and the one seeking it. They are both good. They are both worthy. This is another critical feature of the finding treasure metaphor in Proverbs. Only those who are worthy of it based on their willingness to seek and search and sacrifice for it, are worthy of finding it. And so, with this foundation for understanding the finding treasure metaphor firmly in our minds, we go to the next line of the parable in Matthew 13:44, which reads, "Which when a man hath found, he hideth." The parable starts with a hidden treasure, the thing of value, the kingdom of heaven. According to what we know from Proverbs about seeking and finding treasure, we would expect nothing less than a worthy person to come seeking for it. Someone crying out from the depth of his heart for the knowledge of God and the kingdom of heaven. But instead, we find a man who is not actively seeking treasure at all. He just finds it. And then he immediately covers it back up. Based on finding treasure in Proverbs, what are we to make of this story so far? What questions might we ask ourselves? We might ask, who is this man? Is he a good man? Is he a God-fearing man? Is he worthy of this treasure? Because the parable lacks specific plot development, we don't know the answers to any of these questions, because we're not told anything about this man one way or the other. But because he is not explicitly said to be a man worthy to find such a valuable treasure, the parable is breaking the form of the common Old Testament biblical treasure story. And in this, there is perhaps a bit of a forewarning as to where this parable might be heading. Now, the other aspect of this line of the parable that is not explained is, why does the man cover up the treasure after he found it? And we'll get to this a bit later. The last line of the parable says that for joy therefore goeth and selleth all that he hath and buyeth that field. And so the story abruptly ends. We're not told what happens to the man or what becomes of his newfound treasures. But the storyline is clear. He cashes in all that he owns, and he buys the field for his own. And so by implication, the treasure is his. But this story Jesus told leaves us with some difficult questions and potential problems. And this is where I get into a possible ethical problem that Jesus may or may not have intended to be part of the story. This is the part that I said earlier would be food for thought. If how the man found and went about keeping the treasure is intended to be part of the story, then its implications in connection to how the treasure is like the kingdom must be considered. So let's dig into the question of how the man found the treasure and what he did to make it his own. It is only after the man buys the field that we realize that he is not its owner. So we ask ourselves, what was he doing digging around in someone else's field? Logic would suggest the man was not some sort of trespasser randomly rooting around in someone else's property, but was a field worker or laborer of some sort doing a job he was hired to do, which would seem to require some sort of digging into the ground. And his hiding the treasure immediately after finding it was, in all probability, to conceal it from not only other laborers who might have been working in the field, but also from his employer, the property's owner. In considering the man's actions, you might ask yourself, was it moral? Was it ethical? Was it even legal? Can he get away with it? Should he get away with it? The main moral question at play here is this. Since the man who found the treasure was in all likelihood employed by the owner of the field, what are the rights of the property owner in this story? How you answer this question will determine how you judge the behavior of the man who found the treasure. You might say that when a man sold property and moved away, whatever he takes with him is his, and whatever he leaves behind now belongs to the new owner. Further, you might conclude that if the owner knew about the treasure, he would have taken it with him. And because he didn't take it with him, it proves he didn't know about it. So in any practical sense, it really wasn't his, except in a strict legal sense, that is, as long as he owned the property. Once he no longer owned the property, then the treasure is no longer legally his. It belongs to the new property owner, along with the field. End of story. End of moral dilemma. On the other hand, as a Jew, under the law, in considering your answer to the question, you might go to the law of God in Leviticus 6 chapter and verses 1 through 4 to seek guidance. And there you would read Leviticus 6 verses 1 through 4. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, if a soul sin and commit a trespass against the Lord and lie unto his neighbor, and that which was delivered him to keep, or in fellowship, or in a thing taken away by violence, or hath deceived his neighbor, or have found that which was lost, and lieth concerning it, and sweareth falsely, in any of these that a man doeth, sinning therein. Then it shall be because he hath sinned and is guilty that he shall restore that which he took violently away, or the thing which he hath deceitfully gotten, or that which was delivered him to keep, or the lost thing which he found. It seems to me that the law says, in no uncertain terms, that it is a sin to deceive your neighbor, a sin to find something that is lost and lie about it. It is a sin to get something deceitfully including something lost that you found. And those guilty of this sin were required to restore that which they took and add a fifth to it. And so you might question the honesty and the ethics of what the man did and whether it might be even against the Jewish law. Now, we are not under the law, and we are held to a different standard. And I know it's not always wise or even proper to project our standards, the standards of our day, back on an ancient culture. But for the sake of this argument about the ethics of finding and keeping hidden treasure, let me propose this scenario and ask you to judge if it meets your standards as a consecrated footstep follower of Jesus. Suppose you are a building contractor or a landscaper hired by a customer to work in their home or in their yard. In the process of doing your job, you discover a huge hoard of rare gold and silver coins worth millions of dollars hidden inside of a wall that you just cut into, or in the hole that you made when you just dug up that tree root out in the backyard. What would you do? Would you immediately rehide the treasure? Patch up that wall? Cover up that hole? Then go and sell all your assets and go and buy that property and the treasure hidden in it? Would any of us think that this is what we should do? What kind of rules do you go by to determine when you can flat out keep something that you found, and when do you have to return it, or at least try to return it, to its rightful owner? Now, I would suggest that for those living in Jesus' day, as well as for ourselves today, the logic behind when you can keep something you found might be summed up like this. If what you have found can logically be presumed to have an owner that can be identified, then you cannot, in all honesty, claim it as your own. You must try to locate or contact the owner and return it, if at all possible. In fact, most states today make it a crime of theft to keep lost, mislaid, or misdelivered property without using reasonable measures to find the owner. The law refers to this as theft by finding. So let's go back to our parable. When the man found the treasure, was it his? Can he lawfully, according to what we read in Leviticus and in good conscience, claim it for his own, pick it up, and carry it away? In that case, it was his, and he had no need and no reason to rehide it and to buy the field. Because he did, in fact, rehide the treasure and buy the field, it clearly demonstrates that he didn't believe he could make the case that he could just flat out keep it for himself, no questions asked. Finders keepers, losers weepers, like we used to say when we were kids. And so, if we do consider the moral, ethical, and legal question of how the man went about securing the treasure for himself, the man really does seem to have acted dishonorably. And what do you think is going to happen when the man reveals his newfound treasure and how he got it to all of his neighbors? Because he never gave the original owner the chance to demonstrate his claim to the treasure, but intentionally hid it from him, it's going to be thought that he was acting unethically, if not illegally. And the original property owner will probably sue him and take him to court. It's not going to be a happy ending. And maybe that's why there's no conclusion to this parable. The man can't reveal his treasure because it would not only be embarrassing, but by revealing how he got it, he might even risk losing it. And if he can't reveal his treasure for fear of losing it, the conclusion of the story is that he has an ill-gotten treasure that he cannot spend. Therefore, it is of no use to him. And so he really has no treasure at all. And this is how the man who finds treasure hidden in a field can represent those who are not given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, how it represents those who hear the message of the kingdom but do not go on to bear fruit and become a part of the harvest of the gospel age. And this is where we have to circle back to who is worthy to find and possess treasure. In Proverbs, those who gain the treasure, the wisdom and knowledge of God, actively sought it out. They labored diligently for it, and they were tried and tested before they were deemed worthy of receiving what they sought. In this parable, it's the exact opposite. The man gets the treasure before we know whether or not he deserves it. He gets it before he has proven that he's worthy of it. And isn't this how everyone in the gospel age, including us, gets the treasure? Before we are fully tried and tested, we receive, by God's grace, in faith in Jesus' ransom sacrifice, spirit begettal. And we receive prospective membership as members of the body of Christ. We receive the treasure first, this kingdom blessing, before we have been tried and tested to determine if we are worthy of it, by proving ourselves faithful unto death. It is only ours to keep if we are proven worthy of it. Not everyone who finds treasure and sells all in order to keep it go on to prove worthy of a share in the kingdom of heaven. Many are called, but few are chosen. For those who are running for the prize of the high calling, the finding of the treasure is not the end of the story. It is only the beginning. After finding, we have to be proven worthy to keep it. Even Jesus learned obedience by the things which he suffered. Perhaps how the man who found the treasure and ended up for all practical purposes with no treasure at all demonstrates that not all who start out with the treasure go on to bear fruit and keep it. Now we've looked at those who hear and understand the gospel message. They sell all, they make a full consecration, they're spirit begotten, but they don't go on to bear fruit and become a part of the gospel age harvest. They start out with the treasure, but they don't keep it. But there may also be a totally different class of people who might fit into this parable. Only got about 2 minutes left, so don't Don't get too anxious. There are many who hear the gospel message, but they don't really understand it. They don't understand what the kingdom is or how it is to come about. They don't understand the doctrine of the ransom or the sin offering. Instead, they believe with their whole hearts in their particular church and its particular doctrines. And they are so committed to their man-made organizations, be it Catholic or Protestant or Jehovah's Witness or whatever it might be, that they sell all in service to their organization. They really do fully commit their lives, their all, not to seek to know God and his plan and to do God's will, but to do the will of their organization. Perhaps for these, the joy of sacrificing all is the joy of belonging to and serving their organization. And some of these who have made a consecration, not to God, but to their organization, we sometimes refer to as tares, or sometimes nominal Christians. These might be included in the parable as those who sell all, but never gain an understanding necessary to make an acceptable consecration to God, which results in spirit begettal, nor do they bear fruit and become a part of the gospel age harvest. And this is how the parable of the treasure hidden in the field can have a successful and an unsuccessful outcome, can lead to fruit bearing and to no fruit bearing, can lead to a successful and an unsuccessful harvest. Jesus doesn't give an end to this story. Perhaps he leaves it open because there are two possible endings. Now, I've presented this parable in a way that perhaps you may not have before considered. We usually think of the parable of the treasure hidden in the field in one specific way, with one central meaning, which is Jesus or ourselves selling all for the sake of and to be a part of the kingdom of heaven. I have suggested, as food for thought, that by looking at the potential ethical problem of the part of the story where the man gets the treasure by deceit, we might conclude he is not worthy of the treasure, that he doesn't deserve the treasure, and that he will not have a part in the gospel age harvest. May all of us who have sold all for the treasure hidden in the field prove worthy of it. Amen.